Thanks for downloading this podcast from The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry, and if you're ready, we'll begin. This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry. Thanks so much for listening. And after a weekend of contemplating threats from various corners of the world and reading some alternative views and remembering some troubled U.S. history, we're going to dedicate this program to unconventional wisdom, an hour of au contraire. We begin with the two trouble spots in the world that have grabbed the focus of the Obama administration this year, and I don't mean Somalia, where we learned today that the U.S. has conducted airstrikes against Islamist militants. I'm talking about Vladimir Putin in Ukraine and the Islamic State in Iraq. A ceasefire plan may be in the works in Ukraine. In Minsk, Belarus, there is talk of a prisoner exchange and a Russian withdrawal. Meanwhile, tension persists in eastern Ukraine. And President Obama visits nervous NATO member Estonia on the eve of what is being called NATO's most important meeting in decades, taking place in Wales. In Iraq, the United Nations has charged that the Islamic State has carried out ethnic cleansing with acts of inhumanity on an unimaginable scale. That's quoting the United Nations there. Our first guest has experience formulating U.S. policy on Europe, Russia, and the Middle East going back to the mid-1980s. Senator Richard Lugar, former chair of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee from 1985 to 1987 and again from 2003 to 2007. Senator Lugar, welcome to The Takeaway.
John, great to be with you.
You know, it's great to have you here because I really want to pose some contrary questions to you. I think that you would agree, and most people would agree, that terrorism has an ability to scare everyone in the United States. But people also agree that terrorism and the threats of the Islamic State do not constitute a strategic military threat to America. What if we just ignored the Islamic State? Would that speak louder than what Obama has already said on this group in Iraq?
It certainly would. It would speak very loudly because it's apparent, given the lack of cohesion of the Iraqi government, given the problems of someone putting together some type of coalition involving other Middle Eastern nations, that the ISIS terrorists will continue to expand, and they will be an inordinate problem not only for Iraq, but likewise for Syria. You can ask, well, how does that affect the United States? Well, ultimately, all of our allies and friends in the Middle East are going to be affected by this. It'll be an infection in each of their state situations. And this is likely to be a very bad scene, at least for us strategically.
Well, let's listen to what President Obama said after that, of course, a dreadful video of James Foley, who was beheaded. Here is him talking about the Islamic State.
And no faith teaches people to massacre innocents. No just God would stand for what they did yesterday and what they do every single day. ISIL has no ideology of any value to human beings. Their ideology is bankrupt. They may claim out of expediency that they are at war with the United States or the West, but the fact is they terrorize their neighbors and offer them nothing but an endless slavery to their empty vision.
Senator Lugar, if that is the case, wouldn't ISIS or ISIL or the Islamic State simply collapse out of its own empty vision if it doesn't attract the attention of the United States? We put $1 trillion into Iraq and got the Islamic State as a result. What if we sort of dialed down the rhetoric a bit?
Well, there'll be no point in dialing down the rhetoric because, as a matter of fact, as ISIL continues, it could gain additional strength. Other very dissatisfied young people from all over the world may decide to join this situation and really create havoc. And that has potential for jeopardy of even of the Saudis, for example, and Jordan, clearly, real problems for Egypt. These are all countries that are important to the United States, as well as important to the peoples that are a part of them. And they do not want the kind of governance that ISIL brings.
But doesn't the recruiting of young people, as you've described, become more attractive the more the U.S. gets enraged by ISIS and they can make a claim that, come join us, we're fighting the White House in Washington?
No, I don't think so. I think, as for the matter of fact, although ISIL has issued some statements about the United States and Washington, their objectives for the time being are much more confined. We have problems with potential terrorists with many tribes really throughout Africa and the Middle East, quite apart from ISIL. And we're just going to have to get used to having proper intelligence, drone strikes, other ways of dealing with this.
What would you say to a person who looked at the Iraq situation and said, look, the Bush administration and Colin Powell, I remember it there at the United Nations, claimed that Saddam Hussein was a strategic threat to the United States. We went over, started a war, $1 trillion later, we don't have much to show for it. What's going to be the response to an argument from the White House saying now we have to go after this threat called the Islamic State?
Well, I think for the moment, people, including perhaps the administration, are really uncertain as to how to organize and how to bring about a coalition so that we have at least some people to support, that it's not the United States battle. That will take some time. And I think the president is correct that it's very important for our military commanders, based on the very best of intelligence, of boots on the ground, that is intelligence boots, to give us some idea how we put it together.
We're talking with the senator, former Senator Richard Lugar, former chair of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee from 1985 to 1987 and in 2003 to 2007. Let's talk a little bit about the good old days of the Caspar Weinberger Reagan years, which I'm sure you remember very, very well. Is that all right?
Yes.
I remember the debate over the Cold War and the intermediate range missiles with the Soviet Union would have a certain tension to it, that sometimes the administration would say that Russia is a huge threat to the United States and is actually ahead of the U.S. And then sometimes Pentagon planners would come to Congress and say, no, Russia is really not a threat. We're ahead of them. Do you recall that tension? And how do you think we should use lessons from the 1980s in thinking about Vladimir Putin?
Well, I recall the tension, but I think today is a very different situation. Vladimir Putin has considerable problems of governance inside Russia. He has a country in which an economy of the Russians is going downhill. Certainly, the sanctions that we have employed and the Europeans have employed have pushed things a little bit worse. So that before too long, if we really were to play the sanctions game much tougher, the people in Russia are going to be very unhappy. Now, countering that has been a sense of Russian patriotism that Vladimir Putin has promoted through taking Crimea and now pushing Ukraine. I think he understands that, and for the moment, he's a very popular figure on that basis. But Ukraine is pushing back. Ukraine is nearly bankrupt. They have an army that is weak because they don't have the money to pay for it and the arms and so forth. But at the same time, Putin now clearly understands that given President Obama's traveling to Estonia today and to Wales for the NATO conference, that now NATO people are taking each other very seriously. The NATO thing has come alive. The Baltic states have particularly won bases with not only Americans, but other nations in Europe that are next door to Russia. And the Poles and the Romanians and the Bulgarians really have similar feelings. So Putin has excited now a revival of NATO, and likewise much more of an interest in how logistics support can go immediately to Ukraine, not only from the United States, along with money from institutions in the banking system of Europe, so that Ukraine is going to be in a position to resist for some time. Putin has called over the weekend for statehood for these provinces in near Russia, but then some in Russia apparently said that was a mistake. He really didn't mean statehood exactly. He meant a greater degree of autonomy. And that apparently is the basis upon which the Russians are negotiating now.
Do you think during the Clinton years that the U.S. permitted NATO to expand without really considering what the limitations were going to be when Russia actually saw NATO's borders, you know, in the Baltics moving into Ukraine?
Oh, I don't think so. I believe that the thrust to watch NATO grow and to make certain that occurred has been very genuine and from the United States standpoint has been constant. Now, some have accused the Europeans of having very limited defense budgets, perhaps of taking for granted 50 years of peace in Europe first time in the millennium that such a thing had occurred. It's very possible that people do take things for granted for a while. This, once again, is a part of the problem that Putin has. He has certainly aspirations to see carving out of additional territory, and even more importantly, the building of a Russian Eurasian state of considerable significance. But at the present time, it appears to me that whether NATO was sleeping or not, it awoke very quickly. And for the United States, we were never asleep. We were thinking clearly about NATO and trying to encourage our NATO partners to take part with us in Afghanistan, for example, even if we had to bring transports to cart out the troops from those countries to help us.
Well, NATO's certainly awake now. It's been great talking to you, Senator Lugar.
Thank you so much, John. Great to be with you.
Senator Richard Lugar is the former chair of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee.
My friends, nearly everything around you is going to change within this generation.
Biggest fear in 10 years, not having a job.
Should I go to med school or like nursing school?
You've got to find what you love.
Oh no, the future is here.
My advice to you is to do what your parents did.
Need to get a jobby job.
I want to explore the world and I want to use my craft to do so.
If you haven't found it yet, keep looking and don't settle.
If you packed for college over the weekend, you may have been looking forward to getting back to friends and the freedom of sheltered campus life after a grueling summer of waitressing or interning or numbing your mind in the mailroom. But look at the calendar, folks. How many more years do you have until you hit the real world? 3, 2, 1, blast off into an economy with about as much oxygen as deep space. So here at The Takeaway, because we care about you worried college students and your nervous parents, possibly not wild about the idea of having to eventually support a college grad living at home, we've got a radio job fair. That's right. We'll be open all month long, online and on the air. Tables for every career. MBAs over there. Wow, look at the line for coders and software designers. Not so much for journalists. Times do change. Healthcare booming, some bright spots in manufacturing even. Let's head over to this table. It's not too busy. For information about becoming a lawyer. Hello, Mr. Katz, is it? Daniel Katz, hello.
Thanks so much for stopping by.
Daniel Katz is here to help. He's an associate law professor at Michigan State Law School and director of the Reinvent Law Laboratory with some practical advice for college students looking at the legal profession after they graduate.
I would definitely encourage you to get a broad education. You know, you can take your poli-sci classes, your econ classes as well. But I would say you want to make sure that you make yourself into a well-rounded individual. A basic background in analytics or quantitative thinking. A basic understanding of technology. A basic understanding of project management and process engineering. Basic understanding of finance and accounting. Being able to read a balance sheet. So when you come in and tell me I went to law school because I didn't want to do math, that's not going to cut it in my class.
All right, what about law school? Can I decide to go to law school at any time? Do I take a break before I go to law school? Is law school, you know, kind of a junior college affair, you know, compared with undergraduate or maybe even graduate study in one of these specific fields like STEM?
Well, I would encourage you to make sure you understand what it is that lawyers do before you embark on a legal education. It's not something you should just do because you don't have any other better option. You know, it often involves taking on significant amounts of debt, and it's not something you should do trivially. You should do your due diligence.
What's the debt I can expect to take on?
I mean, it depends on exactly which school you go to, whether they have a scholarship or financial aid, but it's significant. You know, in many cases, it's $100,000, sometimes more. And so you want to make sure that it makes sense for you. In general, I would favor folks having some professional experience before they do it because they have clearer conceptions of what it means to be a professional in a workplace. They have some industry, perhaps, or some area, maybe it's nonprofit or something, where they have some substantive area where they've spent a little time and they've learned some things.
So is that the best way to get a sense of the experience of being a lawyer, you know, actually spending time in an office? What about a book I could read that would tell me what the experience of being a lawyer is like? We're asking everybody that in every field.
Well, I recommend a book that's not really about the law, but it's about a mindset that I think you should take regardless of whether you're going to be a lawyer, if you're going to be in anything, which is The Startup of You by Reid Hoffman, is the founder of LinkedIn. We assign it in my class because I think it sets the right tone that you're your own personal startup and you bear responsibility for, you know, your own success and failure. I like to mix that with a message of, I'm here to help you, but you have to help you too. And so what are you doing to establish your own brand, your own identity, your own professional skills, and broadcast that in an appropriate way to would-be employers?
What's the state of employment in the legal profession right now?
The industry is undergoing a transition from, you know, what you might characterize as a sort of an artisan or guild sort of a style of organization to a more manufacturing or efficient method of delivering services. This is why we really push sort of the lean methodology, which is really comes out of manufacturing. If you think about the production of legal work itself, the lean methodology is something that can be fruitfully applied to the work that lawyers do. And there are some very large law firms who are beginning to apply some, and corporate law departments that are beginning to apply that type of methodology. Better, faster, cheaper work. I mean, the thing I've really been emphasizing is that sort of most of legal education historically has been kind of a liberal arts mentality or a liberal arts sort of centric education. And I would say what I've been trying to develop is a polytechnic legal education. And so I'm writing a paper right now to sort of try to describe this. I would go out and try to explain this to people. People didn't know what I was talking about. And I said, you know, if MIT had a law school, they'd still teach law there, of course, but it would be, it'd have a very different orientation to it. And so I sort of think of what that's sort of my North Star is trying to build an MIT school of law.
So is there a lawyer type in your view and in the classes that you have where you would see somebody and go, you know, you should be a lawyer?
Well, I think if you think about, you know, what is it that lawyers are doing is they are reverse engineering complexity for people. The world is awfully complex. The legal system is awfully complex. And so they're reverse engineering complexity. I think that the great lawyers are kind of, you know, there's a Daniel Pink book, A Whole New Mind, which is about sort of left brain and right brain types, and that people that can kind of switch modes between left and right brain are sort of, you know, very well positioned. And I think that's a sort of characteristic, and it's rare in people. They tend to be sort of all one or mostly all one or mostly all the other. Folks that can kind of get the optimal ensemble of the two, I think, are well positioned. You know, one essential characterization of everything that lawyers do, I mean, there's all different types of lawyers working in all different types of context. And so that diversity means that any sort of single essential characterization isn't going to totally hit the mark.
So the country club, confident, sort of Winklevoss type of personality isn't necessarily what you need at all.
Not necessarily. Obviously, there is always a question that I pose to my students, which is you need to figure out how you're going to get clients. I mean, at the end of the day, your ability to practice law is sort of relative to your ability to have a client who's willing to pay you money for your services. And so it is important to have some strategy about how that's going to happen. I had a student that owned a daycare facility, and there's actually a lot of legal work. It's not something I know a tremendous amount about, but she said, you know, there's a lot of legal work, a lot of compliance work that has to be done in running this daycare facility. And her clients basically are all the daycare folks that she knows from working in the industry. And I thought that was very astute, that she had a business plan for how she was going to get her practice off the ground.
All right, Daniel Katz, Associate Professor of Law at Michigan State University, the Director of the Reinvent Law Laboratory. It's been great talking to you.
Thanks so much. And I hope you go to law school.
I got to go to the nanotechnology table next, I think.
Okay.
You can check out all of our suggestions at the Takeaway Job Fair by going to thetakeaway.org/series/jobfair.
Support for The Takeaway comes from TiVo, unifying cable, on-demand, and streaming apps like Netflix without the need to switch TV inputs, remotes, or user experience. Learn more at TiVo.com.
Later in the program, we will look at the issue of genetic modification of plants and the controversy over human-created genetically modified strains of agricultural products. But first, we look at a project to use genetic engineering to restore a natural species wiped out by humans a century ago. The North American passenger pigeon was once the most common vertebrate on the continent until it was barbarically hunted to extinction. Can passenger pigeon DNA be made to live again in a living cell of another similar species and bring back the bird? Ben Novak is the scientist leading the passenger pigeon comeback. He works for Revive and Restore, an organization aimed at enhancing biodiversity. Ben, welcome.
Hi, John.
So let's talk about the methodology here. Are you taking old DNA from some specimen in a glass case somewhere and cloning a real passenger pigeon or combining it with some other DNA?
Combining is the best way to say it. So it comes from old specimens from collection drawers and maybe some dusty cabinets somewhere, but we take a tiny bit of tissue and extract the DNA fragments from it, which can be very small, old and degraded over time. And we decipher what the genetic code once was. And then the next step, of course, is to try and engineer them into a living pigeon, mainly because these tiny old fragments, they're not alive anymore. But the code can be recreated in a living species of pigeon.
And is this like the Jurassic Park idea, which I thought was complete fantasy, where you take the DNA from the amber and put it in a lizard and you get dinosaurs?
It is somewhat like Jurassic Park. There will be no frog DNA, I promise. But we are actually able to sequence nearly the entire genome of a passenger pigeon and really finitely engineer code to recreate the passenger pigeon. But very similar concepts.
What is the limitation here, and when do you think you could actually, try a clone out?
Well, the limitation is the cloning step. So for a bird, cloning the way people are familiar with, from the famous Dolly, the sheep, it's never happened with a bird, and it might not even be feasible to do with birds. But people have done this really crazy thing called germline transmission, where they can take the germ cells, and these are a type of cell that will become the sperm and egg to create fertile offspring. They can take those from one bird and pass them through a separate host bird. There was actually a duck used to transmit chicken spermatozoa. And so this duck, this living male duck, has the sperm of a chicken and breeds chickens.
To make this self-sustaining, you got to get a boy and a girl, right?
Exactly. So the idea is to take these germ cells and from a band-tailed pigeon, that's the closest living relative of the passenger pigeon, and we engineer the passenger pigeon genome into these germ cells, and then we place some in a male, some in a female, and these look like regular band-tailed pigeons, but when they breed, they're uniting the engineered sperm, the engineered eggs, and what hatches is the passenger pigeon that we've created.
So, Ben Novak, the last captive passenger pigeon was named Martha. You got a name, Martha Prime, for your first clone, if you're actually successful?
That's the first time I've heard Martha Prime.
Yeah, it's not very catchy.
The first one really needs kind of a great name, I think. Maybe we should have a national-wide vote for ideas.
Well, we can definitely give some thought to the name, and we have a whole range of people and their takeaway radio listener clones who can come up with names for you.
The one name that's been passed around is Passenger Pigeon 2.0.
Boy, that's dreadful.
Yeah, I know.
Yeah. But that's typical of you Sunnyvale types out there in California, right?
Yeah, this is Silicon Valley. Everyone's got to put the high-tech spin on what this is doing. But, the essence of this project is the conservation, the idea that the wood pigeon of the East has been missing for 100 years, and we'd like to restore that ecological role.
Ben Novak, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Speaking to us from Sunnyvale, California, Ben Novak is leading the project to bring back the passenger pigeon. He works for a company called Revive and Restore, a biodiversity nonprofit.
You're listening to The Takeaway from WNYC and PRI Public Radio International in collaboration with The New York Times and WGBH Boston Public Radio.
Intervening in biological processes to mass produce food has always made some people who value nature above all nervous. But when scientists developed the capability to directly select genes in food species, the anti-GMO movement was born. GMO stands for genetically modified organisms. Activists like famous worldwide crusader Vandana Shiva have successfully kept a number of strains of genetically modified seeds off the market out of a sincere concern they might be dangerous. But the movement's tactics are often at odds with science and may hurt the very people in the developing world. Indian leader Vandana Shiva, who's trained as a physicist, not a biologist, claims she's trying to help. Mark Linus is a visiting fellow at Cornell University and author of The God Species, How the Planet Can Survive the Age of Humans. He was one of the founders of the anti-GMO movement in the United Kingdom and has fought alongside Vandana Shiva. But he now believes that the skeptical anti-GMO movement has become more anti-science than pro-nature and pro-health.
Skepticism is a reasonable place to start when you're assessing a new and potentially very powerful technology. So I don't have a problem with that. And, you know, I think my own activism in the past, you know, I was very strongly anti-GMO. I was one of the original anti-GMO activists here in the UK. You know, I personally was involved in destroying trials of GM crops, canola, sugar beet, maize, and I felt very strongly about it. But at that time, I wasn't well informed about the science, to put it mildly. And it was really only through writing scientific books about climate change, so a different topic, but I became more scientifically literate, and I realized actually that you had to look at facts which were produced by the scientific community, not sort of just what you were hearing, what I was hearing from the environmental campaigning groups who were all against GMOs already. But eventually I felt it was better to be honest, if you like, than sort of keep it as a dirty secret.
What do you make of people like Vandana Shiva, who's really attracted a huge constituency around the world and has a lot of power in determining how certain nations in the developing world deal with GMOs?
Well, I have a big problem with that, because essentially Vandana Shiva's case is that farmers in developing countries are better off being poor and better off using outdated seeds and outdated technologies. You know, she's somebody who gets paid $40,000 in business class travel to go and jet around the world to make speeches about how great it is to be a poverty-stricken Indian peasant. And so I have a big problem. I think it's important for people in developing countries, farmers in particular, subsistence farmers in particular, who've got their families to feed, to be allowed to access better crops, to be allowed to access agricultural innovations which can improve their livelihoods. The whole GMO debate, I think, is very skewed. People who are against it are against GMOs because they imagine it means, you know, big evil corporations, a model of industrial monoculture, which, you know, I'm not in favor of either. But it's a much, much broader field than that. And there's many ways in which genetic modification can actually be used to improve environmental outcomes.
Let's take some of the Shiva claims, some of which may have been embodied in your original position, and take them individually. GMO crops cause farmers' suicides in India and throughout the developing world because the frustration over price or something else.
Yeah, I mean, this is a claim which it's a myth essentially, but it's one which is universally believed by people on the left, for far as I can tell. But, you know, the rate of suicide has declined in rural parts of India since the genetically modified cotton became available. And in fact, you'd expect that, because it's been a huge saving for farmers not to have to spend money on pesticides. So it's a big benefit both for the environment, for biodiversity, and for farmers' health and livelihoods. So this idea that it's been somehow a terrible disaster for farmers really is a myth, and it's one which needs to be addressed, I think, because it's actually a huge success story. Farmers have on average, it's brought, I think, several hundred dollars increase for most farmers' livelihoods.
The other claim is, and this Shiva and other activists make, is that GMO crops mess with nature, pollute the sort of DNA pool, spread pollen to other crops in the wild, change ecosystems. What do you say about that?
Well, all of these are sort of claims which don't apply uniquely to genetically modified crops, to apply to any crop. I mean, every crop spreads pollen. If you're producing seeds, you need to ensure that you keep your flowering plants separate from those which could cross-pollinate. So this is completely normal stuff for farming. So these claims really don't have any basis or any special reason to target genetically modified crops in particular. So what it comes down to essentially is a sort of romantic appeal to the naturalistic fallacy, the idea that natural is always good. I think in industrialized countries, there's this kind of backlash where people feel that their ways of life and food supplies in particular are too artificial, and so everyone wants natural, the organic, and so on, and the genetically modified is seen as unnatural. But, I mean, really, there's no scientific basis to this. It's a sort of emotional position.
Talking to Mark Linus, who's the author of The God Species, How the Planet Can Survive the Age of Humans. Tell the story of golden rice and how that really symbolizes what GMOs might do in the developing world but are prevented from doing.
Golden rice is aimed at targeting vitamin A deficiency, which is a form of malnutrition which is estimated to kill between 1 and 2 million children per year who don't have enough vitamin A in their diets, primarily because they're eating white rice and very little else. And so the idea for golden rice was to put beta-carotene, which is the precursor of vitamin A, into staple food, into rice, which people are eating. It's called biofortification. It would actually supplement their diets and would prevent both the deaths and also the blindness, which are caused by vitamin A deficiency. The problem is that this has required genetic modification of rice, which has made it a target for campaigners. Greenpeace has campaigned against this for over a decade. Just this last year, there were campaigners who went and destroyed golden rice trials in the field in the Philippines. So you had this really quite extraordinary situation where a potentially life-saving intervention is being destroyed by activists who are ideologically opposed to it. And, you know, this has become one of the major currents, I think, in the GMO debate, is whether even humanitarian interventions should be allowed if they use genetic modification.
Have you come so far in your transformation of your position to have sympathy for Monsanto Corporation, which really is at the center of the demonization campaign, and, you know, has some issues to answer for here? Are you sympathetic? Did they get a bad rap?
I think that's a difficult question. I mean, I'm not in the business of helping out Monsanto. What I would like to see is an opening up of the tools of biotechnology so that they're not just in the hands of big corporations. I mean, to try to ban the entire technology because you're against a single company, it just is flat out illogical. It would be like trying to ban computers because you're against Microsoft or something.
To sort out the bad science from, you know, the reasonable argument here, is there any argument against GMOs or some change in the way GMOs are being marketed that you would endorse in the midst of all the confusing claims that are being made, that you would stick with as a criticism of GMOs right now?
There's nothing specific to genetically modified crops which should single them out for special treatment, even special regulatory treatment. I mean, all of the claims that are made about superweeds and resistance, all of those things apply to conventional agriculture of any sort. The science has moved on so significantly in the last few years that the term GMO, I think, is becoming increasingly meaningless because there's so many different ways now of modifying, editing the genome, moving genes around, deleting genes. When people want to know, is something GMO or not, it's not really something which scientists can give a clear answer to, because, of course, everything we eat, every domesticated crop, every domesticated animal is genetically modified from its wild relative, but not done necessarily in a laboratory, which is, you know, the way of doing it, which is now considered artificial and so horrible.
Mark Lanis is visiting fellow at Cornell University, author of The God Species, How the Planet Can Survive the Age of Humans. Mark, thanks so much.
My pleasure.
Mark Lanis ends our hour of unconventional wisdom with a critique of the anti-GMO movement. We invite your alternative views, and we know they are out there. You know how to reach us about this or anything we talk about on the program. 877-8MY-TAKE. Send us a tweet at The Takeaway or check us out at thetakeaway.org. Thanks so much for listening. I'm John Hockenberry. This is The Takeaway.
Support for The Takeaway comes from the Henry Luce Foundation for increased understanding of East and Southeast Asia, and the Rockefeller Foundation, whose transportation initiative is promoting equitable and sustainable developments in communities across the country.
I'm David Remnick, host of the New Yorker Radio Hour. There's nothing like finding a story you can really sink into that lets you tune out the noise and focus on what matters. In print or here on the podcast, The New Yorker brings you thoughtfulness and depth and even humor that you can't find anywhere else. So please join me every week for The New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.